from MLU headquarters in Philadelphia. This is Cleats and Cuffy. Everything ultimate, from the field to the border.
Welcome to Cleats and Cufflinks, back again, here with Dusty. And Dusty, I think this is going to be a regular thing. Anytime you're in town, we basically take advantage of that situation and just get you right out here.
Well, I like coming on, so it's not taking advantage too much. It's a chance for me to remind myself that I'm talking about Frisbee a little bit.
Yeah, I like that. Or basketball, as last one seemed to go in that direction quite a bit. So we're back at Cleats and Cufflinks. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us. This is, and I forgot to check this beforehand, so I may be wrong because I sometimes am, but I believe it's episode 30. Big number. We're hitting the big 3-0, which I think is that's the date where you really hit maturity.
I've been told that's the moment. Yeah, but I didn't experience a big switch at that time. It was just kind of the same. I gotta tell you, 35 or so, that was different.
35 was a big difference for me. I felt like that is when I started to understand what back pain was. It was right about that time. So we're here. If you're listening to this right now and you've just downloaded it or just gotten it via the YouTubes or the MLU TV, this is Christmas Eve, so happy holidays to you and your family. Happy New Year's, happy whatever you celebrate. We're obviously recording this well before then. So,
otherwise, I would have been wearing much more red and green.
Yeah, I would have had more of a sweater thing happening.
Snowflakes, maybe?
Oh, I wish I had a snowflake sweater. I would kill for a snowflake sweater. My wife wants the sweater from the Game of Thrones that it has like all of the heraldry on it and says Christmas is coming.
I've got nothing on that.
No?
I can't watch all of it yet, so I haven't started watching it.
You're just waiting until...
I need to be able to binge watch, as they call it, on all of it.
Okay.
I don't like waiting.
Okay, I can understand that, because this is actually the first show in a long time that I've waited for, and it's terrible. The show runs for like 3 months, then you have to wait till the next spring.
Well, hopefully then I'll be able to catch up in time to watch the finale or maybe the last two episodes in real time. But it's a race.
You would think a show that is mainly about the horror of winter would understand that having to wait through a winter to watch it would be unsettling.
Or that's exactly what they're trying to go for.
That's what they're going for.
They're trying to make you experience the world that they're in.
All right. I get it. We've had a couple of interesting things happen this week that we'll touch on just really briefly. One is we had, Luke has been for a long time, Luke Ryan, our head statistician, has for a long time been trying to get people's attention on stats. Many tweets, many emails, just trying to get people to care. And no one was responding. He was getting very frustrated.
He was getting frustrated that I was the only one saying, yes, give me more.
Yeah, yeah.
What more complicated questions can I ask you that you can't answer yet?
Yeah, yeah. Luke is essentially saying, challenge me. I have answers. Who would like some of these? And not many people stepping up. But we had a recent article. And you probably know actually even more about it than I do at this point.
Well, a little bit more. It put it up on 538, the politics and sports numbers blog site. I don't know exactly how you define it, because it used to be based on Grantland.
Yeah, it used to read Nate Silver writes for them.
So they do a bunch of things looking at numbers, and at this point, essentially, Jody Avergan, who does some of the podcast hosting in there, mm-hmm. works with them now, used to play in the MLU. I played with him on Pony back in the club days as well.
Great player. We love Jody.
But he also coaches and was coaching, I believe it was the U23 team at Worlds. And there's this experience where when you attempt to scout other teams, it's difficult. It's not just difficult because you're going out and trying to watch these players and whatever and try to understand what's going on and what their strategies are. But when you break down into the numbers, you don't have anything else to compare it to. There isn't any readily available data set for these games to just sort of get a glance at it. So if you look at numbers from other sports, you can just take a glance at teams. Oh, in football, do they throw more or run more? It's very simple, but it's available.
Right.
So what are the very simple stats that are available for Ultimate? And he was kind of opining that I would like those.
Kind of none at the moment in a lot of spaces. And so the 538 ran a story that basically said, Ultimate's made a couple of small forays into analytic data, but has never really committed to it, missing the fact that really we have kind of committed to that at least over the past 3 years that we've been in existence. So Luke actually reached out to them and said, hey, we have that.
How would I like to share that with you?
Yeah, how would you, Any number of ways. And it was great because they actually responded. They're apparently doing a follow-up, and which may have come out before this comes out. I don't know how quickly they turn things around over there.
Beyond my ken.
Yeah, yeah. But
one of the problems, though, when we talk about stats and we talk about the idea of someone asking about them. So what is it that they're asking for? We don't actually know yet because we haven't been looking at the data often enough to know what somebody asks for when they say, could I have a statistical breakdown of this game? Well, what is that?
Right.
Which data is important and which data isn't?
And we've been talking about that a lot lately, and you've actually been pretty involved in these conversations because we're building a new box score. We're building a new way of looking at the game and breaking down the kind of data we have. Because the raw data is one thing, right? If anyone out there wants raw data, we have that.
Lots of it.
You know, we have an API. You can hook right into it. You can figure it out. But being able to present that in a way that it's understandable and useful. And we talked about this earlier, like the ways in which stats are useful. You just brought up scouting. Right, so very important to coaches who are looking to evaluate other teams. I would say probably also important to coaches looking to evaluate their own teams.
Yes, that was what I was going to bring up. You've already done it. Yeah,
there you go.
Me to it.
But what else? What else? What else do we have there?
That's the question. We don't even know what the data tells us because we're not used to looking at it yet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think in-house, right? Content is going to drive that. We know that. We know it drives fantasy stuff. How valuable is it? You know, you spend time on camera, you spend time on the microphone at games. Right. Like, how valuable is not only, obviously, live stats, but the past must inform the future,
and
inform
live stats,
the present.
Live stats are a little more difficult to come by just because it takes manpower and time, and you have to be versant with the system so that you can use shortcuts and get all that data in. But having the stats beforehand where you can go back and look at individual players, look at individual games, that gives you an idea of what to expect going into a game. So just because you see a team take 30 passes to score, that doesn't necessarily mean the defense was really good. That may be their style of play. Mm. So where's the data that backs that up? If you see a team that tends to throw deep very frequently, early on in their possessions, does that mean that it is a bad throw if it's not completed? Or is that their style? Are they relying on their defense once the disc is down at the other end of the field? And it's simple things like that that just inform the picture a little bit more. So when you're talking live on TV, you need to have an idea of what has happened before, what's going to happen next. And setting up those expectations, even when you're wrong about what's going to happen next, the ability to do that makes it much easier.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also, you know, it's interesting. I think the fluffy stuff is also fun, right? Don't get me wrong, but I think from an entertainment perspective, when I'm watching a game, I like to know that somebody's about to break a record or that somebody's about to, like, have some big, you know, changing moment in the sport. Like, those milestone kind of things are really exciting too.
But even less than the milestone, what's the record for goals scored? Is it 15 in an untimed game? If you're playing to 15, does somebody score 15 goals?
Can someone score all of those 15?
I mean, you just don't know. What are the records that have been shown over a tournament, over 4 games of play, over 8 games of play?
Yeah, and that's the challenge, right? So we have data. So if anyone wants to know, a lot of these questions we brought up, like, we have internally. And we are even still trying to figure out how to parse that and make it useful to people, obviously.
And one of the big questions for me is that I played and coached and all of this. I was involved in Club Ultimate long before MLU came around, and I was involved in college and all of that. So my frame of reference is that. That's my natural understanding of the sport. But I can't put that understanding into numbers and then compare it to what is happening in the MLU. So my instincts, I trust them pretty well. That doesn't mean I'm 100% correct. So how do I know that a player is getting more touches per point than they would in another context? And how can I import the knowledge that I have from somewhere else into this slightly different framework where we're working with time games and we're working with larger fields? So I don't know what the differences are because there isn't enough data to compare.
I'm upset because
you look it.
In 2004... and we played together, and I had a turnover-free season, and there's no statistical record of that anywhere in the world. So now it's just going to be me at, like, 75 years old telling my grandkids who are playing pro, well, you guys are doing fine,
but let me
in
tell
2004,
you. Show me the record.
I went to semifinals at Club Nationals without a turnover. Okay. I also didn't throw a single throw over 10 yards.
And believe it or not, the backhand form was better than the forehand form, but the forehand was the throw we relied on.
Much, much stronger throw for me, much stronger throw. I think that I'm going to be really interested to see if 538 is interested in seeing what we've been working on, because, you know, they are experts at this stuff. They're experts at statistics. Getting some feedback on what we're doing is going to be really interesting. I also hope it brings some attention to the fact that we're doing it, because one of the things that we talk about a lot is different perspectives on data are going to expand not only the way that we use the data and present it, but the way we collect it. You know, we may find that there are different things we need to be gathering. And we have the capability of gathering, I think Luke told me today, 52 data points per throw. We could do that. We can collect that much data. We just have to prioritize it, because manpower is always an issue. So we prioritize it to a certain data set. But maybe we need to add something to it. Maybe we need to subtract something. And having more eyeballs on it, having more people interested in analyzing it and understanding it is great. And I think that people literally don't know that we do it. They don't know we have it, and we have it.
Well, and that's, again, that's a matter of what when they come to you and ask, what kind of data do you have about this? They don't know how to frame the question so that they know what they're looking for, because looking at the raw data is difficult. I've seen Luke pulling data out based on questions that I asked, and you have to translate it into formulas and this and that, and it's not impossible, but it's not something that I could do naturally.
I'm told those are called queries.
Well, it all depends on what you're working in, right? It's just different terms that mean the same thing.
Yeah, same thing. But anyway, we'll see where that gets. And you know, we got a little hung up there, but I really wanted to get you back in here, because we started a conversation last week that if people were actually capable of following its many divergences and subpaths and you know,
examples.
distractions and examples and basketball.
I can't help myself.
Yeah, no, I know. We're going to try to steer away from basketball for the beginning of this conversation.
The first sport you love, it never changes.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I got the thing with soccer. Yep. I keep coming back to it. People yell at me all the time. But we started talking about something interesting, which was this idea of kind of the elder statesman in the sport and how important it was that people who came in as great players and have played in ultimate in general, you know, in the club scene or in the pro scene as these kind of pivotal players, how they are able to not only maintain relevance as players, but also transition to a point where they're building up youth and they're building up younger players. And, you know, you came up over since the last time we talked with a few examples you wanted to talk about. And it's important, I want to put a caveat on this, that you have mainly written and talked about and played on the East Coast.
Right.
So these players are East Coast players that we'll discuss, and my hope is that I can find actually in the next couple of weeks someone to Skype in from the West Coast with a West Coast point of view to be a counter to this. And so maybe it's Ben Beener. Ben Beener, you out there? You ready to come on? he likes to talk.
Well, and part of it is that it's not only just, I mean, working with the league, I've paid attention to the West Coast a lot.
Of course.
I don't know the players outside of this context that much. So my ability to talk about their progress over time as players.
3 years is not enough?
It's just not yet. I mean, there are players who have shown a lot of improvement over that time. But to know who they were before is kind of the instructive piece here. And on the East, not only have I covered them and watched them play, I've played against them. I've played with a lot of them. And it just gives you a different knowledge base to work from.
Yeah, so I don't want to, you know, I bring that up because I want people to understand the context in which you're coming from, and then we're going to go out and find out why all those players on the West Coast are better and more interesting and more important than these players you're going to bring up here. But let's dig in.
Right. So, and it's not even necessarily digging in. As soon as I left after the last time, I was like, oh, well, who are those players in our league, and shouldn't I be able to answer that quickly? And then I looked back over some of the players that I knew, and I was like, oh, they were literally right in front of me, specifically starting with Kevin Moldenhauer.
You just tipped your hand, though. You just explained to people that going into that podcast, we had no idea what we were going to talk about.
Well, I had a couple people that I thought would be good people to bring up, and we just didn't have I didn't know how to talk about it.
Yeah.
And now I've thought about it a little bit more, and watching the way that these players have interacted and played different roles. So Kevin was the first person that I mentioned, and he was a player coach for DC the very first year, and then he coached for the next 2 years and is going back to playing this year. That in and of itself is a strange set of circumstances.
Yeah.
But when I first met Kevin, it was playing on Pike in 2004. But that's not the first time I saw him play. The first time I saw him play was at college regionals in 1999.
For Salisbury.
Salisbury. And this was a scenario where, you know, I didn't know who this guy was, but he was... He kept making these plays, and he kept running so hard and so fast. And they toppled Princeton to send them into all this backdoor thing and all of that. And it makes a great story, but the way that he's changed over time in his ability to not just do those things on the field, but to communicate them to his teammates and to ask them to do more and to, that's what leads you into being able to be a coach. Some of the other players who came immediately to mind also should have been obvious to me right away is when we talk about Trey Katzenbach down here in Philly, it's the same thing. When we first met him, he was a receiver, and he was a deep receiver, and he would go up and get the disc and body people out, and it was a great cutter. But he didn't really have throwing capabilities. He learned how to do that as he played. So he developed himself as a player, and that ability to make yourself a better player step by step is one of the things that can lead you into being able to coach players.
I mean, you see it all the time. I played with Trey as well back then, and he takes all of that, and all that competitiveness and all that stuff still carries over. But I watch him take this into Summer League.
Right.
Like, he plays the Summer League here in Pata, and there are literally entire draft strategies, on-field strategies, just hoping to beat Trey, because Trey is very good at encapsulating what he wants out of his team and kind of giving it to him. A future coach, I would be willing to bet.
Well, so that's part of the thing that we talk about, is that in order to raise the level of your teammates, there's a couple ways to do it. One of the things that Kevin and Trey both do is they don't just show excellence, they demand excellence from their teammates, and they don't settle for less. And you can do that in a confrontational manner, and you can do that in many different ways. But just setting the standard that I am going to demand more of you.
And could we say that for both of those players, because I've played with both of them myself, that for both of those two players that they have grown into the ability to do that a little bit? Like that they have...
Right.
Because...
Consciously.
Consciously, yeah. Yeah, definitely consciously. Because, you know, both of them when they were younger and when I played with them had a very different kind of approach and attitude. Not very different, actually. Less evolved. And so as they've grown up into it, it feels like that they've moved forward in that quite a bit.
And this is one of the things that if you describe the toughest players to play against in practices, Kevin and Trey are at the top of that list. So they're not giving you any quarter in practices. They're going out to beat you. And it's the same way when you face them as an opponent. And that's what we mean when I say demanding excellence. The other two players that I wanted to mention just briefly here are Jeff Graham, who is up in Boston now, and has spent time playing around, was at UMass Amherst in college, and was just, he was this player that you would hear these things about, and you couldn't believe them. And then you would go see him play, and you're like, I think that he scored or assisted on 14 of the 15 goals in this game. Is that normal?
Is that possible?
Right. And then you look back and you think about it, you're like, yeah, well, our best defender couldn't cover him, so of course.
Yeah.
And so he, as well as Ben Faust, who has been playing with the Rumble, they're both a little more reserved in the sense that they're not demanding excellence from you. They're modeling excellence and requiring it from you. You know, so it's not that confrontational style as much, though far be it from me to say that either one of them are not competitive or anything like that.
Oh,
that's
no.
not what I'm implying.
No, that's not a real thing.
It's just the way that you approach it, and it's a challenge to your teammates, like an overt challenge versus an expectation. Like, mm-hmm. I need more from you because I need to share the disc with you.
So you're saying that rather than that direct thing, this is a, I've done all of this and now you should be here so that we can continue what we've begun, where we were taking it, even within a point.
Right.
You know, I did a lot of work to get us here. You need to be making that cut, and I'm expecting that from you as a player. So we take these guys, and you know, I think the key to all of them is that they've had long ultimate careers at this point. Kevin's been playing; he's been to nationals every year since when?
2002.
Every year since 2002, he's been to
in
club
open.
Nationals in open.
And that's, I'm sure there. I imagine
if
that
only
there
were statistics
who have done more than
we
that.
We talked
some
about
of them,
this.
Some of them might like to tell you exactly how much more they've done than that.
Yeah.
But it's the sort of thing where you look at that record and you say, that's a lot of success.
It's significant, yeah. And, you know, I remember Jeff Graham from kind of being one of the core founders of Twisted Metal and starting that team up in Boston, which has evolved the Boston Ultimate scene from in the old days of Death or Glory. You know, I don't know. I mean, Trey, we played with, you see like a basketball player.
Yep.
Who brought basically basketball skills to the Frisbee field and turned them into a dominant use of space,
and
has since grown into a now a dangerous part of an offense in terms of being able
Kevin
to distribute.
Kevin also is bringing skills in from basketball.
That's true. What is it with basketball?
And
are we going back to basketball again?
There's a pivot, but it's the key is that it's not just one sport that brings you skills into ultimate. It's just that those are the sports that these people happen to have played. The issue with this is that how do you translate that and how do you get that competitiveness and bring that out in your teammates without breaking them down? And that's something that is personal. You can't always do that right away. Some of us are so competitive that we can't stand someone else being good around us because we need to be better than them. So you kind of learn your way out of that. Or some people have been, are they just
that's
naturally
kind of Michael Jordan, right?
Right. Like, yeah. So based on my experience and based on what I know of Ben and Jeff, they're not about breaking players down. They were always about building players up. And the rest of us kind of have to learn how to do that. I wasn't always good at it. Mm. I still may not be. It's the record, the jury's out yet.
Yeah, no, I don't think I have anything to do with that. so, all right. So I love this idea and I want to continue this. And I want to get some West Coast voice on this because I'd like to hear about some of the players that are out there and players that I don't know as much about. Again, like you said, right. I know them really well through the MLU. I don't know as much about what they did before that. From college and club and all the other things that they've done. So if you have information on that, hit us up at Cleats Cufflinks, at Nick Darling, at, you changed this again, Dust Tweet R?
R, yes.
Dust
Much easier
R.
to pronounce.
Dust Tweet R.
Dust Tweet R. Dust Tweeter.
Dust Tweeter.
Both of them work.
Dust Tweeter. I like that.
Right. It's a pun. We all love puns.
Yeah, we love a good pun.
Or is it just a, anyway, homonym.
Homonym. So we'll talk about that more. But we started an interesting thing there in that last piece where we said, people are bringing skills from different sports and different things. And we talked a little bit about this earlier today when we were sitting around the office here, which is sports have kind of a fundamental essence. Like you can get a sport down to some basic idea. And every sport has something that's a little bit different. We talked a little bit about football. Like what is football's sort of fundamental essence, its fundamental thing that it teaches you, not only you know as a player, as a person, et cetera?
The team is more important than you.
Yeah.
And B, that you have to work with your teammate almost in lockstep. If you are one step off, if you're taking the wrong size step at the wrong time, or you're trying to block too many people, or you're not hitting the right hole as a running back, it's not the sort of thing where you get to improvise necessarily on every individual play, depending on who you are. It's the sort of thing where we have a plan. We've practiced this X number of times, Y number of times, and we have to go out and do this perfectly. And if we don't do it perfectly, one of our teammates is going to get their block knocked off. So there's sort of this payback if you don't do it. There's immediate feedback on whether you've done it correctly or not. And part of that is that a lot of football requires pain to do. It's difficult to do all of that. So you're all giving up something for the team.
And even defense is a super organized disruption rather than a creative reaction.
Very specific.
You're not really reacting to what the offense is doing. You are meeting it with something that's already also pre-choreographed and pre-coordinated and in lockstep together. Because, you're working against what they're doing in a way that is prepared. Now, it's not to say that football players don't make tons of adjustments on the field and tons of choices, but
what I was going to say is that in part those roles are based on the rules of the game.
Right.
Linemen can't catch passes.
No.
So it's this sort of thing where each player has their role. Like not everybody can receive, can be under center and be the quarterback. You don't get to do that. One guy has the ball at a time. And he's not allowed to throw it to some of his teammates. So no matter what they do, that's not their role. They have to do this other thing, which doesn't actually involve the football. It involves moving humans around.
Oh, it's a weird game. The amount of stuff that goes on a football field that doesn't have anything to do with the football, I think, is also speaking to it. The object of the game is less involved than it is in other sports in a way. And then you take that all the way in the other direction. You look at something like soccer, where it's teaching you something different.
Mm-hmm.
It's, there is a it's about having individual expression, but balancing it with a strategic movement that your team is trying to make. Can you speak to that any more clearly than what I just said?
A little bit, but the thing with soccer for me was just that I grew up playing soccer as a kid. That's what my my father coached soccer and all of that. And the thing with soccer is you don't all get the ball all of the time either. And it's not, yeah. your teammate can just take the ball, dribble down the field, and score. They don't need to share with you.
It's so true. So I played with a guy named Dima Kovalenko. He later played for the Chicago Fire. Really great soccer player. But I played with him when we were really young, and we were playing in like, not even like travel team yet. This was like rec league soccer where you got a t-shirt and, you know. We played with him, and he was the nicest kid. Just the nicest kid ever. So he would get out there, and he'd want to share and want to be nice, right? That doesn't win you games in soccer, though. If you're really good, you can just go ahead and go win.
Puts the ball a lot of times.
So at the end of the game, the coach would be like, "Hey, Dima, we're down 3 goals. Can you just kind
of just go take care of this?
Can you go do that now?" And he would just do it. He would just dribble through everybody and score. Dribble through everybody and score. And you realize that, you know, there is a, unlike some other sports, there is a huge reward for individual skill in soccer that maybe doesn't exist elsewhere. That can be a positive. But it can also be a negative if you don't happen to be at that top level as early.
Right.
So the development of players is challenging. You know, the academies and things that develop these players have that struggle where they got to figure out, is this player going to be good and I need to nurture them, versus the kind of like, you know, savant that is happening, like the six-year-old who's just tooling on everybody. And that's what's interesting. And that conversation brought us to ultimate, right?
As it always
thankfully, because we didn't get into basketball, so we actually got to ultimate eventually, and we said, like, what is quintessentially different about ultimate? What's at the core of ultimate?
So, the thing in ultimate is that you can't score by yourself. You have to throw it to your teammates. You have to share the frisbee.
Yeah.
Unless you're scoring Callahan's over and over again. And generally when you do that, someone else has pulled the disc or there's been defense or whatever. You can't do it without your teammates. So this sharing is baked in to the rules of ultimate. It's
what
not
other,
in football. It's
what
not
other
in
sport
soccer.
Is there? What other sport does that? I was
been
actually just trying
to
think
up
of that.
With that.
I actually didn't think of that before. I was trying to think of it now, though. But in baseball, you can hit a home run. Yeah. In hockey, you can take everybody on and get down there and score. You can do that in soccer. Basketball, you can bring it down the court and Steph Curry that thing in from 85 feet away. You don't even have to bring it down the court. You just, you just shoot.
Do the Charles Barkley and just go straight for the rim and see if anybody's going to get in your way, too.
Yeah, and see if anyone's that dumb. I love Charles Barkley.
So the thing is, there is, what is the nature that we come up with when we are required to share with our teammates? And what does that mean? And not only that, even if you have the disc, you can't hold on to it to the end of the game. There's a stall count. You have to get rid of it. You have to throw it somewhere.
You literally have to throw it to somebody.
Otherwise, you're just going to give it to the other team, and no one on your team wants that.
No one's happy about that. And I think that's what it comes down to, because I was trying to place this and trying to put it into words when I was talking to Lindy Sabloff. Mm-hmm. We were talking about our nonprofit that we're starting to build up and how we want to do youth outreach and why that's important and what our kind of mission is. And we're like, well, there's something, you know, ultimate's good for kids. It lets all these kids play who might not be comfortable playing other sports. It invites mm-hmm. people in. It's inclusive. And I never really got to the core of why it's inclusive until we were just talking. And it's the fact that you literally have to share.
And
you have to.
You can't even practice one-on-one ultimate. That's not a thing that you can do. You can play one-on-one basketball. You can play one-on-one soccer. You can even play one-on-one football. You can play with 100 yards, and the other guy just has to tackle you.
You can play one-on-one ultimate. It's just handing the disc back and forth as the stall count expires.
Because I guess you realize at that point that you need teammates, and I might as well treat this guy on the other team as
yeah.
my teammate.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, that's about the only solution. I think that's an incredible thing about the sport, and I think it's something that deserves actually more time than we're going to be able to give it today, because we are running down on our clock a little bit. But thinking about that and thinking about where that takes the game, I think this is the message that we could give and the way that we could sell this game into community centers, into schools, into things like that. It's not just that it's cheap, right? All you need is a disc, right? That's a great sales pitch. But to build on that and say, this is a game where if you're on the field, you're included, because you have to share. You have to play with others. And you have to learn to rely on your teammates for something more even than a block or the proper movement. You have to rely on them to be able to receive the disc and get it on to the next person.
And within that context, it's even a sort of thing where you talk about dominant and non-dominant strategies, where it's just like, even in basketball, it's not the best thing to have your best player shoot all of the shots. In ultimate, it's not the best thing for your best thrower to throw all of your deep shots. One of the things that a great thrower can do is throw to players who are covered and get them the frisbee. So how do you get the best out of these assets that don't give you as much out of a pure skill or a pure reward thing?
And there is more benefit in ultimate to doing that than there might be in other sports.
Stretches the defense out, requires more from the defense, gives you more ways to attack on offense. The rewards for sharing in ultimate are unlike they are in almost any other sport because you don't have an option.
Amen. Well, Dusty, you are the only person that I do the show with where it seems like 30 minutes is way too short. We will get back to this discussion. We'll have more of it. Until then, if you want to reach me at Nick Darling on Twitter, you can email us at cleatsandcufflinks@mlultimate.com or you can get us on Twitter at cleatscufflinks. You can also get Dusty here at dusttweetr.
Very good.
DustTweetr.
Yes. You can also get me at dustyroads@mluultimate.com.
Oh, that's also ML Ultimate. Yeah, that's another option. You can do that too. Thank you all for joining us. We'll be back again next week on Cleats and Cufflinks.